It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.
Hello and welcome to Care Talk, where we talk about how healthcare works or doesn't work in America and answer your health insurance and healthcare questions. I'm Laura Packard, a cancer survivor and healthcare advocate, here to help you. Please text or call in your questions at 202-838-6837 and we'll answer them in future episodes. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcasts wherever you get your podcasts to get the next show. And now I'm thrilled to introduce Dr. L. Sane, infectious diseases fellow physician and epidemiologist and advocate with Doctors for America. Welcome, Dr. L.
Thank you so much for having me, Laura.
Thanks for joining us. And today I wanted to talk about the recently announced cuts to healthcare in America through the Department of HHS Health and Human Services, and also the ongoing cuts to research. So tell us what just got announced.
Yeah, so on March 27th, it was announced that the Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS, is cutting 10,000 additional employees. That's 20,000 individuals total. That's across the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, which is our leading biomedical research infrastructure in the U.S. That's across the Centers for Disease Control, which is our main federal office of public health, the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, and then also across Centers for Medicaid for Medicare and Medicaid, CMS, which oversees Medicare and Medicaid insurance in the U.S. So together with the prior cuts and other loss of staff through buyouts, that's about 20,000 people that will have left the Department of Health and Human Services since the start of this administration, which is about a quarter of the workforce total for our national public health infrastructure.
And what does that mean for the average person? How are we going to be affected by a quarter of the department leaving?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when we think about federal healthcare, we kind of think of it as, you know, this behind the scenes, not really big part of our everyday life. And that's when public health actually is working best, is when it's behind the scenes and you don't notice it. But there's quite a few big buckets that these changes are going to fall into. And each of those has implications for patients and for the US public as a whole. So I think of it as the financial cuts that are happening. So this is taking back funds that were promised to the states and to state health departments. And this puts communities at risk because it means that our local health departments don't have the funds that they need for surveillance and for vaccination programs. There's capping indirect costs of research to universities, literally the money that keeps the lights on, maintains equipment and academic research. And then the cancellation of ongoing research grants, including, active studies that are happening. They've also announced that they're reducing the National Science Foundation's budget. That's more science and engineering as opposed to healthcare, but they're decreasing that by about 66%, and that will be across all 50 U.S. states where that impact will be felt. And then there's a personnel loss, so that's a termination of scientists. But also with both the personnel loss as well as the financial changes, we're going to see elimination of student training opportunities. So a lot of the funding from the NIH that goes to universities helps pay for doctoral and postdoctoral training programs as future scientists are establishing their career and eventually setting up their labs. And with the loss of that money, we're going to lose those future scientists who are trying to figure out the discoveries and the cures for the health issues that we face tomorrow. And so that's going to have long-term implications for public health and for research infrastructure. And then the last part that I think about it is structural. So the actual reorganizing of health and human services. And so this involves the threat of eliminating programs such as the Center for Disease Control's HIV prevention program, which is the main program that implements the ending the HIV epidemic, which is our national strategic response that was actually announced by President Trump during his 2019 State of the Union to address the HIV epidemic and to end the HIV epidemic by reducing new infections by 90% by 2030. And so I'm concerned that that and other divisional programs that are essential to public health, that we don't know yet what that organizational restructuring is going to look like and how that's going to impact these different institutions that are critical to the health and safety of all Americans.
Mm-hmm. And we don't even know yet, since this is not done, how this is going to affect somebody signing up for Medicare. Is there going to be delays? Are they going to have problems getting Medicare, Medicaid, Affordable Care Act services, everything that runs through the agency? If a quarter of the staff are lost, how is that going to affect people's day-to-day experiences with healthcare in America? We just don't even know the answers to that yet. Can you explain a little bit, all of these cuts, 20,000 people, this is the same or this is separate from Elon Musk's DOGE that's going into agencies and cutting people left and right?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I will say, I think that that's one of the more complicated things to piece out, in part because what we know so far is that an announcement has been made, and that announcement seems to come largely from the Department of Health and Human Services. But there seems to be at least a real integration with DOGE's initiatives of what's happening, especially with the first round of terminations that we saw. That's essentially, between the people who took the buyout packages and then the initial round of DOGE sweeping through agencies and terminating multiple positions. At least that part of it is definitely, DOGE had a heavy hand in. The extent to which they're kind of more active versus this is just kind of a continuation of that work in a more integrated process isn't entirely clear. I think that the bigger concern overall is that some of these programs that we're concerned about potentially being eliminated or rolled into other programs where there isn't quite the infrastructure there are congressionally, that Congress had been a part of developing those programs. And so ensuring that the infrastructure and the oversight is there as this reorganization takes place, and trying to understand what the scientific and public health underpinnings of it are, because at least at present, with the limited data that we have, there's not a clear indication of how this will benefit science or public health, but there is a lot of concern that this will have negative implications on both.
And the research funding issues that happened in January, February, where grants were paused and researchers couldn't actually pay their staff. Now, has that been resolved, or are there continuing to be funding freezes on public health research across the country?
Yeah, so there's multiple things that have happened and that are happening, and this is part of that. So many things are happening day to day that it's really hard to keep up with what's going on. So a couple of the things that happened. The first was the communications freeze that started basically almost immediately after the inauguration. And what this did was this essentially blocked the publishing of notifications of scientific meetings, including grant applications. These meetings have now just resumed, but this was quite a significant delay. It also, the NIH is resuming posting notices to solicit grant proposals. And so saying these are essentially the areas that we're interested in grants to fund research within. It's now been announced that each notice is going to be required to undergo approval by one person at Health and Human Services and one person at DOGE. That person at DOGE is not likely going to be a scientist or have the understanding to really make a good scientific judgment about the merit of that research. And this is for notices that have already been approved by NIH advisory councils of independent scientific experts, which is a normal process. And so there's concerns about how that may delay research. And then between January 22nd and now, only three published notifications have been put up, as opposed to 163 in 2023 in the same period, or 147 last year. And so a significant delay in the notifications of new opportunities for awards. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which funds the predominance of research within infectious disease research, had 27 of the 41 notifications that they intended to publish in this fiscal year have not been published yet. And so there's been huge delays there. And so that's kind of one component of it. And so we're starting to see a little bit of movement, but it's definitely delayed. And then the meetings of review of grants toward new grants has been really delayed as well. So then kind of separate from that, there's the issue of indirect costs. So indirect costs are a part of a grant that is essentially what keeps the lights on at universities. And so this is a portion of the grants that help pay for things like utilities, lab maintenance, specialized equipment, administrative costs. And there's a long history behind the indirect costs and the role for academic universities and academic medical centers, but these are really important, and they help ensure that science moves forward and progresses and pays for the practical aspects of science. And so the administration had put out that they wanted to cap those indirect costs at 15%, which would be a fraction of what those costs normally are. That has now been put on hold, but that's definitely something that's kind of in the background as well, because that will fundamentally change how research is funded and how research practically, particularly basic science research, practically works on a day-to-day basis. And then there's a component of cancellation of active grants. So Health and Human Services has about 42 pages of canceled grants to date. And so each of those pages has a couple of dozen grants on it. And these are active awarded grants that have now been canceled at some point in the process because they've been determined not to be aligned with the current administration's priorities. And this cancellation of active grants doesn't just impact the primary researcher or the science itself. It impacts education, the research pipeline, and other staff who are supported by the research grants. And some examples of this are long COVID research. This was in the news quite a bit last week that the Health and Human Services had closed their Office of Long COVID Research and Practice as part of the reorganization, but also terminated funding for several post-viral long COVID studies, including $1.7 billion of NIH initiative. Some or all of these terminations have now been rescinded, but that was definitely a concern at the end of last week. They've revoked $11.4 billion of COVID funds from health departments. These funds are part of infrastructure and active surveillance at health departments. And then they've canceled a slew of grants that fall into areas that they've deemed are not consistent with their current administrative priorities, such as studies on vaccine hesitancy, studies on LGBTQ health, as well as studies on health disparities and several HIV-based studies as well.
So it sounds to me, by having somebody from Elon Musk Doge review everything, this is kind of like when health insurance companies have some random person decide that you don't deserve the care that you need and your tax dollars are paying for. So we'll see how this continues. People may be feeling pretty helpless right now because we're seeing all this research get cut. We know that this means fewer treatments and fewer cures. What, if anything, can people hearing all these news do? Because HHS is run by RFK Jr., who answers to Trump. So it feels like there's limited avenues to do something about it.
So I think that definitely from the perspective of researchers and doctors, we're very concerned, but also from perspective of patients and the public, just as you said, like it's very concerning. And I have patients, so I'm an infectious diseases doctor, and I have patients who have definitely expressed that they're very concerned to me. And so things that that we can do is we can call our legislators and we can tell them what the impact is. I can talk about the impact on me as a physician scientist, but I think it's also really important to hear the stories of the impact from patients and the concern about how this is going to impact your health and healthcare. I think our voices are very important. And sharing what our experiences are with legislators is really key. And so calling your representatives, letting them know about your concerns. If you can get someone on the phone and you can talk to them, that's great. But even if it's just leaving a voicemail, to really draw to the attention how much this matters for everyone, not just scientists, I think that that's really key. And it works. Because we saw, you know, the reversal of these long COVID studies that were defunded. We saw that rescinded last week. And so I think that there is some hope in terms of responsiveness when we say, like, this isn't what we want. And that is a hope that I see.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Alsayn from Doctors for America. And please keep us updated on what's happening to health research in America. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Laura. Have a good day.
Thanks. And now I'd like to introduce Louise Norris of healthinsurance.org and Diane Archer of Just Care and Social Security Works to answer your questions. And first, we'll go to Diane to talk about what's happening on our healthcare from the administration in this past week.
So thank you, Laura. You had a great conversation, uncovered a lot of ground. I think that 20,000 job loss at HHS is huge. And I want to focus just for a couple more minutes on what's happening at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The numbers there are at least projected to be lower in terms of cuts. So only around 300 people is what people are talking about losing their jobs. But these are people who staff the Medicare hotline, who work on drug price negotiation, and who set payment rules, among many other things. So they're really important to the proper functioning of Medicare and Medicaid. And we have no clue, with a loss of 300, what the implications will be. But fewer staff on the hotline when you're waiting for the hotline now a long time to get answers to your questions is not likely to lead to a more efficient Medicare hotline. We also know that CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, is responsible for issuing hundreds of millions of insurance cards. And again, with fewer staff, will people get their insurance cards? The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is responsible for paying for many, many, many millions of treatments, medical devices, and drugs. Again, fewer staff can make life particularly challenging for tens of millions of Americans, both patients and healthcare providers when it comes to their healthcare. And that's all we know for now. But again, as Dr. Sain was saying, we should be calling our members of Congress if we're struggling to get what we need from Medicare and Medicaid or the Affordable Care Act and letting them know about any issues we're having.
Thanks, Diane. And our first question is from Laura from Virginia, who I bear a resemblance to. I'm self-employed and get my health insurance through the Affordable Care Act marketplace. I've always paid out of pocket for dental and vision care while I had an ACA plan for regular health care. Can you tell me more about dental and vision insurance options, both on and off the marketplace? Are they regulated like Affordable Care Act plans and have good value if you get them through the marketplace? What happens if you go directly to an insurer or buy a plan through an online search? And can you only get plans during open enrollment, or could I sign up for a dental plan tomorrow? Louise, talk us through how this works.
Sure. So this is a great question, and it really depends on whether you're getting coverage for an adult or for a kid, and whether you're getting coverage through the marketplace, integrated with a health plan, or purchased off the marketplace. So the Affordable Care Act did define pediatric dental and vision care as an essential health benefit, which means if it is integrated with a health plan, like actually as part of the health plan, or if a dental plan is purchased for a kid through the marketplace, the plan can't have any caps on how much they'll pay in benefits. And actually for pediatric dental, if it's purchased as a separate plan through the marketplace, like in addition to a family's health plan, there will be fairly low caps on out-of-pocket costs for the family's pediatric dental services. There are not rules like that for adults. And vision care, vision is for kids is just integrated with the marketplace health plans. They all include vision care for kids, and some of them will include vision care for adults, but that's less common. You cannot buy a standalone vision plan through healthcare.gov, but you can buy a standalone vision plan, you know, for adults through some of the state-run marketplaces. So your access to vision coverage through the marketplace will depend on where you live. For dental coverage, you can get standalone dental coverage through the marketplace. It is just like health insurance. It's limited to open enrollment or a special enrollment period. And again, those are the plans where if it's a kid enrolling in the coverage, either by themselves or as a member of a family, the kids' coverage will have caps on out-of-pocket costs and no limit on how much the insurance plan will pay. For adults, none of those rules apply. For adults, even if you get your coverage through the marketplace, there will typically be a limit on how much the plan will pay for your dental care. And it's usually in the range of like $1,000 to maybe $3,000 per year. So these plans are not going to cover very significant dental needs. You know, if you have you need a filling or you need a crown, something like that, yes. But if you are in need of, you know, very significant dental services, you will hit your maximum out-of-pocket cap, there is no maximum out-of-pocket cap, you will hit your maximum benefit cap before you get all the care you need. So dental plans, you can purchase them year-round outside the marketplace, but if you're an adult, there are not regulations on these plans, regardless of whether you're getting them in the marketplace or outside the marketplace. So if you want to go and buy a dental plan right now, it's outside of open enrollment, you don't have a special enrollment period, you would be doing that through a private insurance, you know, you would just be going directly to an insurance company, either on your own or with the help of a broker. But you are going to find that the plans generally have fairly low benefit caps. They will typically have waiting periods for more significant services. Like they'll cover minor things right away, like cleanings and x-rays, stuff like that. But if you need significant dental work, they will generally have a waiting period of at least 6 months before they'll cover that. So that's the caveat to the fact that the coverage is available year round. And then if, again, if you need significant care, it's going to be, you're going to run into that maximum benefit cap. So this is an area that, you know, is again, contacting your elected officials. If you would like them to discuss the possibility of adding, making adult dental and vision coverage comparable to the rules that apply to pediatric dental and vision, this is certainly an area where you can reach out to your elected officials to talk to them about this.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I need to decide if it's worth it. And just, you know, you can't advise, everybody's situation is different, but do you personally have dental insurance or do you just pay out of pocket?
My family does not have dental insurance. We are also in the marketplace. We are self-employed, so we have marketplace health insurance. Because we are very familiar with the benefit caps, we know that a dental insurance plan would only be there for us for fairly small procedures. So instead, our local dental office just offers a family annual membership plan that we pay a fee directly to the dental office. And for that fee, we get everyone in the family gets a free cleaning and checkup once a year. And then we get discounts on any other services that we might need. And for our family, that has worked out. Everybody has to make a different decision, but there are not dental plans available for adults that will sort of cover, you know, whatever you need, even if it's very significant stuff, the way there are for medical care.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that teeth and eyes are not considered body parts along with everything else is a whole other discussion. So Diane, talk about how this works on Medicare, because I understand that Medicare Advantage sometimes includes these plans, but traditional Medicare does not. So how does this work for Medicare?
Okay, so let me just set things straight with Medicare Advantage. It is true that many, if not most, Medicare Advantage plans do offer some vision and dental care. But what the data is showing is that people in traditional Medicare get as much dental and vision care as people in Medicare Advantage, suggesting that the benefits that are offered in Medicare Advantage are extremely limited, forcing people to go to a very small number of providers and also costing them a lot out of pocket. Although the data hasn't all been collected, that seems to be where we are. And so to your question about regular Medicare, as you said, Medicare does not cover routine dental and vision services, but it does, I want to add, pay for procedures to treat, for example, a chronic eye condition like a cataract, as well as glasses you need post-cataract surgery. And it pays for annual eye exams if you have diabetes or high risk for glaucoma. So if you have Medicare and you have a special health condition, it's worth checking to see if because of that condition, you may be eligible for vision care or even sometimes dental care when it's related to some other jaw problem or a bodily problem. But there's also some other options with Medicare. There is this fabulous program that most people do not join, which they should look into, called the Program for All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly. Those are for people living alone who are aging in their communities. And it's a comprehensive care program that does offer, in many instances, vision and dental care. There has been a lot of work on these programs, and there are now a bunch of for-profit ones. What we know for sure is the nonprofits have been working extremely well, so they're worth looking into. Also, if you have Medicaid, depending on the state you live in, you may be eligible for free routine vision care as well as for dental care. In addition, and this applies to people who are not on Medicare and Medicaid as well, there are throughout the country hundreds of federally qualified health centers, sometimes called community health centers. And those centers, a lot of people are not aware of, but they often do provide free or low cost sliding scale dental and vision care. So it's worth looking to see if that's available through your community health center. And then there are a few other programs, and people should know that those are now available through healthcarevoices.org/caretalk. You can go and look at this list that I'm going to go through. You don't need to be taking lots of notes right now, but they're all up there on healthcarevoices.org/caretalk. But they include the VA, which may cover your eye exam and glasses as well as your dental care. So if you're a vet, you may have that coverage. If you look up Eye Care America or National Federation of the Blind, you may find programs in your community that can help you with vision care. There are dental schools around the country that often offer free or low-cost dental care through their clinics. So you might want to look into those dental schools and see if one is offering that for you. There's a Dental Lifeline Network that uses a core of 17,000 volunteer dentists and 3,700 dental laboratories to provide dental treatments free of charge. And then there's finally Dentistry from the Heart that also is a worldwide nonprofit organization that helps people get free dental services. So again, I would start with looking at your federally qualified health center, your community health clinic, because they may be the answer for you. You could also call your state health insurance assistance program for free advice, or go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk, and you can look at the different options available and find links to for contacting them.
Thank you, Diane. And thank you, everybody, for joining us today. Please text or call in your questions to 202-838-6837. Join us next week for more on healthcare in America and get your questions answered. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Laura Packard, and this is Care Talk. Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out of control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.